नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। Going to read this morning the first verse of chapter 9, canto 3. The chapter is entitled Brahma's Prayers for Creative Energy. And this is just after Brahma has seen Garbhadakshay Vishnu after long, long penance and austerity. The form of the Lord is seen by Brahma, and Brahma understands a lot. He understands this is the source of my existence. He understands this is my master and the one who I'm to serve. And where it's going is he understands he has his service is to create. So here's Brahma's words. Translation, text 1. Lord Brahma said, "Oh, my Lord, today, after many, many years of penance, I have come to know about you. Oh, how unfortunate the embodied living beings are that they are unable to know your personality." Of the Lord. My Lord, you are the only knowable object, because there is nothing superior beyond you. If there is anything supposedly superior to you, it is not the Absolute. You exist as the Supreme by exhibiting the creative energy of matter. Back to the verse, that the purport covers a number of things. Purport. The highest peak of the ignorance of the living entity who is conditioned by material bodies is that he is unaware of the supreme cause of the cosmic manifestation. That's a partial answer to your question yesterday. What's the value of, what's the practical application of all of this seemingly very abstract, what does it have to do with us stuff? Covers the living entity. Lacking that covers the living entity with ignorance. Different people have different theories regarding the Supreme Cause, but none of them are genuine. The only supreme cause is Vishnu, and the intervening impediment is the illusory energy of the Lord. The Lord has employed his wonderful material energy in manifesting many, many wonderful distractions in the material world. And the conditioned souls, illusioned by the same energy, are thus unable to know the Supreme Cause. The most stalwart scientists and philosophers, therefore, cannot be accepted as wonderful. They only appear wonderful because they are instruments in the hands of the illusory energy of the Lord. Under illusion, the general mass of people deny the existence of the Supreme Lord and accept the foolish products of illusory energy as supreme. Paragraph. One can know the supreme cause, the personality of Godhead, by the causeless mercy of the Lord, which is bestowed upon the Lord's pure devotees like Brahma and those in his disciplic succession. By acts of penance, only was Lord Brahma able to see Garbhadakshaya Vishnu, and by realization only could he be understood, could he understand the Lord as he is. Brahma was extremely satisfied upon observing the magnificent beauty and opulence of the Lord, and he admitted that nothing can be compared to him. Second time in the same paragraph, Prabhupada writes, only by penance can one appreciate the beauty and opulence of the Lord. And when one is acquainted with that beauty and opulence, he is no longer attracted by any other. This is confirmed in Bhagavad Gita 2:59. Pram drishtva navartate. Paragraph. Foolish human beings who do not endeavor to investigate the supreme beauty and opulence of the Lord are here condemned by Brahma. It is imperative that every human being try for such knowledge, and if one does not do so, his life is spoiled. Anything that is beautiful and opulent in the material sense is enjoyed by those living entities who are like crows. Crows always engage in picking at rejected garbage, whereas the white swans do not mix with the crows. Rather, they take pleasure in transparent lakes with lotus flowers surrounded by beautiful orchards. Both crows and swans are undoubtedly birds by birth, but they are not of the same feather. So Prabhupada is two main things in the purport, contrasting the swan-like and crow-like persons, having different objects of attraction, the crow compared to one who picks at garbage, or the garbage in the metaphor is compared to the objects of material creation, or objects manifested by material energy. And the swans are interested in the Supreme Lord, or the nice lakes and lotus flowers and beautiful orchards and serene setting, as swans are found in those places, not in the garbage heaps. So that swan-like nature is likened to those who are interested in the source of everything, the Supreme. Brahma, so back to the verse, how that relates to the verse, is that Brahma is swan-like, and he's lamenting the condition of those that are crow-like, those that are not able to know your personality. He's lamenting. Or, in other language, Prabhupada saying he's condemning. And then the other main message in the purport is the means by which that realization of the Supreme Lord, the swan-like persons, pursue a life of penance and austerity, that those terms commonly go together, penance and austerity. Penance has the connotation of repentance for some wrong or error. Like, you know, a judge's sentence for a criminal, and he pays his penance, or from a scriptural point of view, some means of counteracting some sinful deeds, like prayaschitta, is another idea of penance. And austerity has more the positive aspect, that is, pursuing some higher goal, foregoing some lower immediate gratification, so that one can achieve some higher goal. Penance has that notion also. The penance of a college student to achieve a higher goal. You undergo some penance and austerities to do your studies for a higher goal, knowledge. At least theoretically. So, Brahma realized the Supreme Lord by that penance, and it's not just two things there. It's not you do something and mechanically you get something. Like, you know, I caused the Lord to appear because I did penance. Not so. Rather, by the causeless mercy of the Lord, one can know the Supreme. And so something that we may do to help invoke the causeless mercy of the Supreme is detach ourselves from that affinity for the illusory energy. That's the austerity and penance. That's what Brahma did. He fixed his mind upon the Supreme Personality of Godhead, which meant that, you know, he didn't do some other things. He didn't. He stopped the program of mental speculation. I wonder if I can find the Lord this way. I wonder if I can find the Lord that way. And gave those up completely and fixed his mind upon the Supreme Lord in meditation. That was his penance. So, well, how does that equate to what we do? Brahma has his duty. His duty is, he's not just going to, you know, graduate and go find a job somewhere. He's going to create a universe. So that's his duty. But in the course of his duty, his first duty he's taken is to realize the personality of Godhead, realize the source of his existence, and he's appreciating what a wonderful manifestation, this beautiful form of the Lord is, and how unfortunate are those that do not undergo that process to know the Lord. Therefore, he's supremely intelligent. Like, you know, he didn't have to get very many prompts to go down the right path. And he has this realization. That's the best of intelligence, the fruit of his spiritual intelligence. Knowing the Supreme Lord now, he's going to be making prayers for being empowered to do his creation work, to do his duty. That would be a nice way to, I mean, a standard of life, that before you do anything, you become God-realized. And then when you continue your duty, you continue in that state of God-realization. It's not like you don't do anything once you're God-realized. You do something to serve the Lord in your state of God-realization. He's setting that standard. Something that Prabhupada doesn't speak about in the purport is a little surprising. My Lord, you are the only knowable object because there is nothing supreme beyond you. While there's nothing supreme beyond him, there are knowable objects, it would seem. like things that come from Him. Although He's supreme above all things, there's other things that come from Him. So the idea here is those things that are subordinate to Him are to be known not just like, you know, here's a mridanga, here's a speaker, there's an amplifier. That's, you know, that's what this thing is, and it has these components, and so on. But that knowledge is another kind of ignorance, because it's in this Bhagavad sense, unless there's any understanding of what is, what's the source of this, the cause of this, the ultimate absolute truth amongst the various relative truths that come from the absolute truth. So, in that sense, you are the only knowable object, because there's nothing supreme beyond you. This is something like the first verse of the Chatur-sloki verses of the Bhagavatam, Aham Evasam Evagre, that says, before creation, I alone exist. During the period of cosmic manifestation, I alone exist. And after annihilation, guess what? I alone exist. So this is another way of saying the same thing. You are the only object that is knowable, because there's nothing supreme beyond you. So the other just say it reversed, as we did. The other objects, they're knowable, properly knowable, in terms of their relationship with the source, and otherwise it's illusion or it's ignorance. Whatever one may know about amplifiers and speakers and mridangas, it's ignorance minus the connection with the absolute truth. It's the illusory energy only minus the connection with the absolute truth. Or, again, say it the other way around. One should know the absolute truth before one attempts to know any other thing. Otherwise, you know, it'll go the other way. That knowledge you have of something is incomplete, and it creates illusion, illusory conceptions and illusory existence and bondage to birth and death and more illusion. Back the other way. The remedy is fix one's mind on the Supreme and become at least inquisitive. Brahma Jigyasa, it's Vedanta. Inquire into the nature of the Absolute, that from which everything comes. And then the next, I think the last, just because of the time factor, if there is anything supposedly superior to you, it is not absolute. And that's another Chatur-sloki verse from Canto 2, Chapter 9. Another Chatur-sloki verse is, if one sees that something exists of substance separate from you, know that to be my illusory energy. Know what exists that is of substance that's discussed in the first canto, the distinction between substance and category. Like, this is a little, we'll just call it a chair for now. This little chair, is it substance or category? And the answer is it's category. Because some while before it was a tree. And some while before that it was earth. And some while before that, who knows what it was. And going out that way in time, now it's a chair. Going out in time is going to be ashes, or again earth. So for now we're calling it chair, so it's category. But what's the substance? Substance is earth, water, fire, air, ether. There's some fire in there too. There's some water in there too, and so on. That's the substance, or And that substance, or that separated energies of Krishna, that's based upon Krishna. He's the real substance. And then there's category. And we mistake, you know, that we get it backwards. This is substantial. Look, this is a chair, and I can sit it, I can, you know, do so many things with it. It's substantial. And this idea of spirit and God, it's like, you know, what do you do with that? So it's an idea of, you know, weak-minded people, and it's insubstantial. That's how materialists say, this is substantial and that's insubstantial. And the spiritualists say the other way around. This is category, and it's resting upon that which is really substantial, and the spiritualist is interested in that which is substantial, that upon which everything else rests, including the illusory energy and the different forms and transformations of those forms of the illusory energy rests upon that which is substantial. So, if there's anything supposedly superior to you, well, there isn't something. So if there is something supposedly, it's the illusory energy. Or it's not the absolute. You exist as the supreme by exhibiting the creative energy of matter. So Brahma's stating, I've got this urge or impetus to create. That's one of the 10 topics of the Bhagavatam, by the way. And this chapter is exploring, to some degree, that topic. The creative impetus of Lord Brahma. And where does that creative impetus come from? It comes from the Supreme Lord. Brahma knows that. He's not illusioned by his own power, thinking it's unpowerful. He's fixed his mind upon the Supreme Lord, so his creative impetus is dependent upon the Supreme Lord and the energy, illusory energy of the Supreme Lord to allow him to work with ingredients and make things, like forms of life and planets and species and the cosmos. By empowerment from the all-powerful, by the substantial, and there's no one above. And there's no thing above, and if someone proposes there's something above or someone above, not so. That conception is illusory conception that's born of the illusory energy. So he's going to keep going with his prayers, distinguishing the Supreme Lord, whose beautiful form and opulent features he's directly perceived. In fact, it's that Lord who he's addressing through these prayers. And in course of time, the relationship of his service unto the Lord is going to be articulated, and his petition for the Lord to empower him to properly do this work of creating. And in the same Chaturshloki verse of the Bhagavatam chapter, most certainly it's going to be in this chapter too, Brahma's praying to the Lord to protect him from the false ego of thinking that he's the creator. His service is creating, but he's not the creator. There's one who is giving him the power, the ability, and the ingredients, and the capacity, and the intelligence, and the self-realization. And he's the instrument of that, the Lord. So he's giving credit to the Lord and praying to please protect me from the false ego, the pride, delusion of thinking I'm the creator. I did it. I created this thing. This is very instructive for us. some service, whatever it is, career, family, social, you know, Vedic society or whatever it is, thinking, I did it, I'm the doer. It's illusion, it's illusory energy. And an intelligent Lord Brahma is praying for protection from that misconception. We should too. And instead stay in a very clear and factual and humble position of simply being the instrument, being the servant. That's another practical application of this knowledge of how everything is coming from the Supreme. It's not just imagination, it's scripturally authorized conclusion. It may not be our full realization like it is Lord Brahma's full realization, but it's realized in our case through hearing. And then when we go about our various duties, we can factually and honestly and practically attribute that to the Lord's energies, which He's engaging us in interacting with in some way to serve Him. And that's what's going on. That's our identity. That's the program. And we can do our service free from delusion. That's practical application. Okay, so let's stop there and see if there's discussion. Yeah?
Thank you. This particular aspect which you suggested, Maharaj, that sometimes causes a little bit of confusion.
Which one?
The final thing when you said that everything is actually coming from the Supreme, so we have to be humble in the sense that everything actually is being done by Krishna and we just are instruments. But in that case, sometimes I'm confused between the line between becoming like lazy and or because we might have to sometimes say, oh, if I do a little bit more, then I think I might do it much better. But then we might in one way think, no.
It's okay to think that first way where the mood is service. That makes the difference between, you know, complacency and taking the next step and doing the needful, because it's the platform of service. On the platform of service, I can take that extra step, and it's not doership, it's being an instrument. What do you think?
This is with respect, this question was, especially it comes with respect to career, because we think in one way, career is also a service, but then sometimes we might have to make a decision, okay, if I do this, then I might have to give up some service or something, but then...
Okay.
So, in that case...
You do them both. That's common, whether it's career or versus service. It's common in life. I don't have a career, in one sense. But when it comes to deciding between this and that, some service and some, this service or that service, here's a way to say. One devotee asked Prabhupada, I have so much service to do, so much service to do, so much service to do. And from morning to night, I have so much service to do, it's hard to complete my chanting. What should I do? So one way is, to diminish the service, because chanting is also service. On this occasion, Prabhupada said, do them both. Don't diminish your service while you're maintaining your chanting, and do them both. And, just for us, here's some practical advice I would say. There's a standard of your capacity, not his or mine or somebody else's, but your capacity. And recognizing that capacity can grow, and it does when there's surrender, Krishna gives you more capacity. But, you know, it's not all at once, it's increments, incremental. So, looking realistically at what my capacity is, this much I know, I must perform my sadhana. Okay? And do it very carefully, attentively. And now, there's some other time I have. Using your example, I have a career, and I have some service, other service besides my career. You know, it doesn't have to be just like the Vedic society. It can be my family and whatever, or cleaning my room or something, or some other service. So, now how do I proportion my time? And going to your question, because career is really important, I know if I do this extra something, that will enhance my career. At least the opportunities may open up more if I do this extra something. But at the same time, there's, you know, cleaning my room and my family and, you know, the Vedic society. And, you know, there's so many other things. So, it's not a question of doership. It's a question of service. The decision where where you choose to place your time and attention, if you're properly situated, it's service. Service or service or service or service. But it's the platform is service, not secular. Service and then for myself. It's simply service. And with career or something that, you know, might be monetarily connected, you just like, you know, you draw a line and say, you know, that's enough. It's like, you know, how late do I stay up at night? And I stay up, I keep a regulation. And within the time allotted, I do it what's needful. And then when the time allotted is over, I take rest because I want to get up early because I want to do my sadhana in the morning. And, you know, so you become satisfied with, you do your best with the expectation that the capacity to do better tomorrow, what better than today's best, is by empowerment, not by if I just do one more thing. So you know, it's keeping regulation within time allotted. So the decision is how to allot your time. And you know, I know that I need to do these various things. I know I need to spend time with my family. I know I need to spend time with because I want to. And I know it will spiritually benefit me, and it's part of my civic duty, it was a Krishna conscious duty, to do something with the preaching activity. And, you know, but I'm not going to like go way overboard with this and neglect that. I'm not going to go way overboard with that and neglect this. So I make an allotment of time and be satisfied. I wish I had more time for each of these things, but I don't. So, you put a cap on it and be satisfied with that. And Krishna, please accept this offering. And the limitation on my side is my attachments, not the limitation is on your side. You're just not powerful enough, or you're not empowering me enough. It's my attachments that are limiting how I can be empowered. So as I'm doing my career and as I'm doing my family and, you know, other various activities, the internal cultivation is that we become free from the attachments of being the doer and being the enjoyer. Let me become situated instead in a mood of service. Please empower me in that mood of service. Then you, your capacity increases. On a devotional platform rather than, you know, simply time management.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay. Anything else?
Yeah. Maharaj, can you explain me a little bit on penance and grief as opposed to lamentation and depression?
Penance and what was the other word?
Penance and grief, feeling deep remorse, grief for missing.
Well, then maybe a better word is repentance, because grief is like, that's extreme. Yeah. In the former, the result is expanded service. In the latter, the result is decreased service. So what's the goal? Increasing service. That which can help me increase my service if I feel some regret or some remorse for neglect, then it's like a springboard to go higher. And the other is the mode of ignorance. You go down. You get sucked into this vortex of negative energy that takes away your enthusiasm and your service. So I don't want that to happen. I want to get closer to Krishna. So let me enter into this space of regretting having been neglectful as an it, with the view in mind, let this be an impetus to not let it happen again and be more determined. That's a very simple rule of thumb. What's Krishna and what's Maya? Krishna is that which increases devotional services. Maya is that which decreases it. That's your job. Anything else?
In your class, you briefly said that Lord Brahma, he did penance, but one thing that he did not do was mental speculation.
He started, then he like abandoned it.
And I was reminded that, you know, somebody asked Srila Prabhupada, how long does it take to go back to Godhead, and he said, you know, just a moment. If you leave behind fruitive mentality, mental speculation.
Yes.
So I can very well see how fruitive mentality affects me, but I'm not sure how you can speculate. I mean, like how can it? How does it affect our life?
In practical ways, like what are some examples of how I might be mental speculating?
Yeah.
It's maybe two major ways. One is interpreting this means that, rather than think this means this. Mental speculation is this means that. And a second is the spirit of what's on the positive side, what's good is an inquisitive spirit. That's Brahma, the inquisitive spirit. He wanted to know. That's not speculation. But when it becomes speculation is where the means that we want to know is by taking our little flashlight and holding our little flashlight to something that's in the scripture and saying, I'm going to like figure it out. Yeah. inquisitive spirit is good. Let's say, a common experience that I have with college students is questions are merely academic, not always, but in many cases, in some cases, merely academic. They have nothing to do with will this help me make advancement in Krishna consciousness. It's born from, you know, I want to figure it out. My little flashlight, here's the Vedas, and how does this fit together with that? But sometimes it says this, and sometimes it says that, so what's going on? The spirit is not like, I want to go to Krishna. The spirit is to figure it out. So, to whatever degree that's happening, that's mental speculation. To whatever degree it's, I want to go to Krishna, and therefore I want to understand this subject matter, so that it will help me go to Krishna. Because that's what I want. And to get to Krishna, I know I need Krishna's mercy, so I want to understand on that basis. That's devotion. And then, by descending way, the illumination, if Krishna wants, will come. And that's what happened to Brahma. That same thing can happen to us. Okay. I'm looking at the clock and the bell's ringing and I've got to go. Krishna. See the Prabhupada, he's had.
His only is wrong, but it's wrong.